Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Beautiful day again.
And we're recording this December 20th, so shortly before Christmas in 2019. And we are having a beautiful day. It's nice because there's still a little snow on the ground, so it kind of looks like Christmas, but the air is warm. So the snow won't last much longer. And by warm, we mean like 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So
yeah, well, that's warm for us this time of year.
It's warm for us. And I think that's warm where Tom comes from, too, where our author today is from originally. So, Mom, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Yes, this is this book is amazing. And the author, Tom Voss, served as an infantry scout in the 3rd Battalion, 21st Infantry Regiment Scout Sniper Platoon, while deployed in Mosul, is that how you pronounce it? Mosul, Iraq.
Correct.
He participated in hundreds of combat and humanitarian missions. And Rebecca Ann Wynn, his sister, is co-author and is a writer based in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this is an amazing book, and it really, really should be read by everybody, really.
And the title is Where War Ends, A Combat Veteran's 2,700-Mile Journey to Heal. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, the book covers a lot of ground, more than 2,700 miles.
Correct, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the impetus behind writing this book.
Well, I think the reason why we decided to write this book was because there's a lot of books out there already that are on the experience of war itself. So there's not too many that are really detailing or chronicling what the men and women are going through when they come home from war. So we felt that it was kind of, I felt that it was kind of my responsibility to be able to be open and honest and share how war impacted me after getting out of the service. And as you know, there's a suicide epidemic in the veteran community of 20 veterans a day that are taking their own lives. So we have to be open and honest about these experiences so we can have these conversations, so we can understand what the men and women are going through when they come home.
And those victims of suicide included some of your former, were they platoon mates or?
Yeah. Since coming home from, or getting out of the military, I should say, I've lost three friends, after the fact. So it really, highlights that, we count the casualties of war as people dying in combat, but there's a lot goes on that's after the fact that we don't really take into consideration, and that's what we're seeing today.
And that's really not new, is it?
No. I mean, this has been going on since war has been going on. It's something that's extremely detrimental. Yeah, it's extremely detrimental to human beings, and seeing how it impacts, and the concept of moral injury is something we talk about in the book, and it gives language around the complexity of the suffering that happens when you come home.
Now, Tom, your healing journey was long, and the book focuses on two aspects of it, one being the 2,700-mile walk that you did. So why don't we start with telling us a little bit about that, and then we'll get into meditation, which is the other thing that really helped you heal.
Yeah, so the trek came about, it was really out of necessity, kind of out of desperation. I was on the brink of suicide, contemplating my own death, and needed to do something drastic to pull myself out of that. So that's where the idea of walking across the country came from, is really to help myself. And I knew that I needed to pull myself out of the environment that I was in to really focus on the impacts that war had on me during my deployment. And that's something that I never really had time to process, you know, the death of my friends, you know, what I participated in, and the bigger context of war itself. So I decided to walk across the country. And at that time, I had a friend that I served with who was living in California, and he was always trying to get me to come out to visit him. His name was Emmett, and I served with him. And one day I just, you know, I was with my sister and told her I needed to do something, you know, just to get out and to be able to start processing some of the stuff that I experienced. And the only way that I knew that I could do that was to, you know, remove myself from my environment and really focus in on these events, these traumatic events in my life. So the idea came about, and within a few weeks, I linked up with my my Iraq war veteran friend, Anthony Anderson, and we decided to do it together. And we, you know, we ended up walking for 5 months straight and covered about 7 states. And our goal was to walk 20 miles a day. That didn't always work out, our goal, according to a plan. But, you know, we ended up finishing it in 5 months. So that's generally how we started doing it.
What was it about this trek that you thought would help you heal? Was it the idea of being alone or almost alone with, you know, time to think? Or was it being outside? Or was it connecting with people along the way? Or maybe some combination?
Yeah, it was kind of a combination. I didn't really have an idea of exactly what I was doing. I didn't know, I didn't really have a healing plan, but I knew I needed to move, and I knew I needed to take the time to be with myself to start processing a lot of these events that I experienced in Iraq. So I felt that walking was the way to do it. You know, the way to, it's slow, it's methodical, and there's nowhere else to go, and you're with yourself the whole time. And Anthony and I had came up with rules for ourselves, just to give us some framework. And one of those was not to listen to music or have our headphones in while we were walking, because that was the distraction from what we were trying to accomplish. And that was to process these things, to heal ourselves. And for me, it was the death of my friend. And for Anthony, it was to be a better father and a better husband.
And how long after the end of your deployment was this trek?
I got out of the Army in 2006, and I struggled a lot. And then we left in, I would have to say it was late September or late August of 2013. So some years had passed that I'd been struggling a lot. And you know, going through VA treatments and different healing modalities to try to figure it out. And this trek was the kind of the culmination of all that.
So this book is important for what I say, everybody should read it, because it's important for veterans and their families, but it's also important for the general public, because we have no idea what really goes on. And, in fact, I don't have an idea what goes on when you join the Army, except I know that you're now, it's, you know, all for one and one for all, and that you have to have that to survive.
But right.
You're told about when you were in training, and if somebody in your platoon goofed up, then the whole group of you had to suffer for it, and that was interesting, I thought. Is that a common practice in the military?
Yeah, it's the reasoning behind it is that, like, we're all responsible for ourselves, and we're all here for the greater good of you know, serving the United States. So they have a lot of different techniques to break down the you know, individuality of people while you're in basic training. And the story goes into detail about one of those experiences where one soldier snuck out of the barracks at night to buy a candy bar for himself, because we weren't allowed candy bars. So he felt that the rules didn't apply to him. So he snuck out and did that and got caught. So You know, in the book, we talk about, you know, it's all our responsibility to take care of each other. And, you know, the punishment ensued after that, because, you know, we're not here to serve ourselves. We're here to serve the greater good of the country. So that's a common practice, I think, in a lot of different basic training and a lot of different branches of the military.
So when one person does something like that, how do the other recruits treat him then? Is it do they forgive him, or, you know, is it, how does that work?
Yeah, eventually, yes. I mean, everyone gets upset because everyone gets punished for one person's action. So there's some people that are pretty hard on him afterwards, but, you know, eventually we understand that we're here for a bigger mission and a bigger purpose. So, you know, it's just like a, I would say, I like to compare to being in a fraternity, but with guns. So there's a lot of, you know, you live together, you work together, you train together. So you form really tight, close bonds. And of course, there's going to be personality clashes and people you don't get along with. But at the end of the day, it's the only job that I know of where, you know, your coworkers are willing to sacrifice their lives for someone else. So it's a very, very unique job in that sense, that you have people that are, you know, willing to fight and die for people that they don't even know back home.
Tom, do you think that practice of breaking down the soldier's kind of individuality and individual will, in a sense, you know, breaking their spirit almost sometimes in the training process, contributes to the difficulty afterwards in reintegrating into society?
I think it adds a challenge, because we're used to sacrifice. We're used to sacrificing. The family members are used to sacrificing. They suffer right along with the men and women who are serving. So we have to, when we get out of the service, no one else has that experience, or not many people are sacrificing. It's more of that we're in a society of, you know, individuals that need to get ahead and strive and do better and be better and all these different things. And unfortunately, sometimes it's at the expense of other people. So that's not how the military works. We're all in it for a common goal, greater than ourselves. So coming out of the service and then being, I would use this example of going into a Starbucks and seeing someone yelling at a barista because their coffee isn't hot enough, or they got the order wrong or something like that. And that's the kind of thing that I think it really, upsets veterans when they get out, because they don't, you know, they're not used to seeing the bigger picture of we're all in this together, and you know, we have to make compromises and sacrifices for the greater good of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, the ordinary citizen doesn't think about that. You know?
Right, of course. This is because it's not in their purview, and I mean, we're all raised, you know, differently in this country, but we all have the freedoms, and we sacrifice those freedoms in the military most of the time.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tom Voss, author of Where War Ends, A Combat Veteran's 2,700-Mile Journey to Heal. And the other subtitle on the book is Recovering from PTSD and Moral Injury Through Meditation. Now, we've heard a lot about PTSD, although I think people mm-hmm. who don't suffer from it maybe don't have a complete understanding of it.
Sure.
And you were at one point diagnosed with PTSD, but you didn't find that a completely, what would you, I don't want the word that's satisfying, but a completely, or basically a complete explanation of what you were going through.
Right.
Why
right,
was
right.
that?
Well, yeah, let's look at post-traumatic stress disorder first, and just to build some understanding around that concept, because post-traumatic stress can happen to anyone. It can happen from being in a car accident or even in a dangerous situation. But it happens more often, I think, in the military or in veterans who have been deployed, because you're in a combat zone that you're in a dangerous environment for an extended period of time. And what ends up happening is your body ends up responding to that danger by heightening your awareness and your alertness, making sure that you can get up out of sleep very easily if you need to protect your life. So this is just a physiological response to being in a very dangerous situation. And unfortunately, when you come home and you're out of that dangerous situation, your body doesn't recognize that and it needs time to process and time to realize that it's not in a dangerous situation anymore. And unfortunately, we're seeing that in combat veterans coming home with flashbacks and different things that happen in society. So to give you an example, when I first got back from deployment, I'd be driving on the freeway and see a trash bag coming up on the side of the road, and I would move over three lanes to get as far away from it as I could, because that's what I was doing in Iraq, because that was a threat. That could have been an improvised explosive device on the side of the road. So that's how my body and mind would respond to threats or perceived threats that I saw. So of course this is, you know, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and there's no threat, obviously. So it's an irrational fear that ends up happening, that ends up moving us to do things that end up being irrational, you know, and also controlling emotions is really challenging, because we don't have the luxury of using a lot of our emotional capacity except for anger in a combat zone. And that's one of the only things that helps us and keeps us alive. So you have all these challenges. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, do you think that reacting like that is as stressful when the danger isn't real as it is when the danger is real?
Yeah, I think it still has the stress factor is still really high. Even though in your mind you're like, I know that isn't real, but the fear is still there, the anxiety is still there, the stress is still there. So that's how it ends up manifesting, at least how it manifested in my life.
Well, Tom, why don't you, and then you were going to go into kind of the next step beyond PTSD, which is moral injury. Do you want to read from your book to kind of introduce us to that concept?
Sure, yeah. And just to kind of set it up is, you know, the definition of moral injury is a wound to the soul. So right away, it's not a clinical term, and it's different from post-traumatic stress. And then after I'm done reading about it, I can talk a little bit about how it's different from post-traumatic stress. A little bit, but this is the preface of Where War Ends, about moral injury. This moral injury is a wound to the soul. It happens when you participate in or witness things that transgress your deepest sense of belief about right and wrong. It is an extreme trauma that manifests as grief, sorrow, shame, guilt, or any combination of those things. It shows up as negative thoughts, self-hatred, hatred of others, feelings of regret, obsessive behaviors, destructive tendencies, suicidal ideation, and all-consuming isolation. You may experience moral injury if you've survived abuse, witnessed violence, participated in the chaos of combat, or experienced any form of trauma that's changed your understanding of what you or other human beings are morally capable of. For many combat veterans, moral injury is inflicted during war, when they are split into two different versions of themselves. The person they were before war, whose morality was ingrained in them by their parents, religion, culture, and society, and the person they became during war, whose morality was replaced with a sense of right and wrong that helped them survive in a war zone. When the smoke clears and the chaos of war ends, these two selves, with two different sets of moral values, confront each other and continue to battle, the pre-war self points to the post-war self and says, hey, I know what you did. I know that I know what you saw, and you were wrong. You are bad, and you can never be good again. A soldier may experience moral injury when reflecting on his or her actions during combat, but they can also experience moral injury by bearing witness to the actions of others. The cool indifference of a commanding officer as he stands over a dying civilian. The capture and torture of men who are known to be innocent. The bomb that was placed purposefully to destroy human life. All can call into question our deeply held cultural belief that all people, deep down, are innately good. So that's a little bit about moral injury and what it is. So to talk about it a little bit more in depth about in comparison to post-traumatic stress, which we briefly spoke about, so moral injury is more of the hard questions you ask after war. You know, am I a good person? Can I be forgiven? Were we justified in our being in Iraq in the first place? And these are the things that I think stick with a lot of men and women when they come home, and it's hard to connect with family members about that, because it's such a unique experience, and there's less than 1% of the population of the United States have served in the military, and an even smaller fraction of that are the ones that are doing the fighting. So we have to see that in my experience, I was suffering from post-traumatic stress, but I was also suffering from moral injury. So years after, when I came home, I started asking myself these questions, you know. The very basic one that I like to describe is, I was raised as a Catholic, so thou shalt not kill. It was ingrained in me from a child. So now I'm put into a situation where I have to. And now society understands that in a war, this happens, right? So then when I come home, and now that I've violated this principle in my life, and now I'm back into society, and now this rule is placed back on me again that I had violated. So I'm struggling with that. I've violated my own moral compass, and can I be forgiven? You know, how am I seen in the eyes of God? All these different things, from a moral standpoint, and that just leads to immense suffering.
Now, you had on your trek, on your 2,700-mile trek, you were accompanied part of the time by a film crew.
Correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah. So while we were walking across the country, we were approached by an independent filmmaker from New York City, who was interested in veterans issues, but didn't know what kind of project he wanted to do or, how he wanted to help. So he found out about what Anthony and I were doing walking across the country and asked if he could join us. And he ended up making a 90-minute documentary called Almost Sunrise that documents the actual trek across the country. So it follows Anthony and I, and a lot of the people that we met along the way. And it gives a really good insight about what Anthony and I and other veterans have gone through when we come home from war.
And this filmmaker introduced you to a priest along the way. And you were, it seemed like in the book, you were kind of expecting some judgment. But what did you find instead?
Yeah, when we were walking across the country, we had the opportunity to meet Father Thomas Keating, who's a renowned priest and monk. And he actually was a big proponent in the creation of centering prayer, which is a form of meditation. So I had the opportunity to sit down with him and actually do an interview and kind of talk about my experience, because at that point he had been counseling veterans since World War II. So he had experience with this, and at first when I sat down with them, you know, it gave me kind of flashbacks of my confirmation in the Catholic Church and how I had to confess to a priest. And, you know, I was expecting judgment and, you know, everything that comes along with that. But I got quite the opposite. He was very open and very, you know, just sitting with him, you know, feeling that he was not judging me. And that's very important when we're talking about veterans' issues, is coming from a place of non-judgment and coming from a place of understanding, or wanting to understand and accepting that these men and women have to do things on our behalf that are extremely challenging to reconcile with oneself. So I was very, very fortunate to sit down with Father Thomas Keating and talk to him about specifically about forgiveness. So one of the key things he actually says in the documentary is that, you know, the question comes to is, can these men and women forgive themselves? And he says the implication then is, can they forgive God for letting this happen to them? So it was a huge turning point in my journey, because I never thought I had the power to forgive myself. I never thought that that power existed within me to be able to forgive myself and to forgive God for the experiences of war that I had experienced in my life.
So, Tom, on this trek, was it successful in healing you like you thought it, you know, basically were the results what you were hoping for when you set out?
Yeah, as I said before, I didn't really know what those results would be or should be. But as I finished the trek, I understood that I had a long road of healing ahead of me. And this was just the beginning of that. And really, looking back on it, that was just kind of warming me up for the work that I had to do. And I set out on the trek to deal with the death of my friends. My platoon sergeant was killed in action, and one of our squad leaders was killed in action. And I didn't deal with that for years, or really even look at it, or really even acknowledge it. And Father Thomas Keating, another quote from him from the film is acknowledging the fact that, yes, this did happen in my life. And that is the starting point, I think, for a lot of healing. For a lot of people is we spend so much time, you know, ignoring these challenging experiences in our lives, and they just keep coming back and keep coming back until we acknowledge that they've happened. And understanding that healing, the healing process in itself is long. It's a long, long process. It's not something that can be done in weeks, and it's taken me years to get to where I am, to be able to speak about it, to hopefully help others understand or build understanding around their own experiences so they can also start their own healing process.
And thus the book, Where War Ends.
Well, you had some challenging physical challenges on this trek too. Your partner had a lot of blisters. I don't know how in the world he did it. How in the world did he walk?
Yeah, there were some days where we would have to take days and rest, and we just would stop into a hotel and get ice buckets and stick our feet in them, and just we'd have to wait. And we did our best. And at the end of the day, you know, being in the infantry, we just kind of would do the best that we could with what we had. And sometimes we would just have to put duct tape over our blisters and keep going. And that was the best remedy that we had at that time. But yeah, there were some days where we would get out of the hotel and walk a block and just be like, nope, not happening today, and then go back and just rest. And that's a really important lesson, I think, is that, you know, sometimes you have to listen to your body and acknowledge that you need rest and that you need to take the time to recover.
Did you train for this? I mean, you were 7 years out of the military. You probably weren't in fighting shape.
Right.
Were you in the shape you needed to be to do this?
Absolutely not. That was one thing. That was one thing that, you know, looking back, like, you know, we should have trained a lot more than we did. I think we only had 3 or 4 training sessions that were really long, drawn-out walks, and we suffered for it. You know, we really did. I think the first day we left on the track, we only made it 10 miles, and our goal was to make it 20 miles a day. So that was took the wind out of our sails, as you could say, literally left from Milwaukee, the lakefront of Milwaukee, and made it back to my parents' house, so that we felt pretty defeated, you know, hobbling back to my parents' house. And then, you know, from there, we just had to, grind it out. And you know, you can ask Anthony and myself, the toughest state that we walked through was Wisconsin, because we knew every landmark and, you know, the highway markers and where we were exactly. And, you know, more, it's like 90 miles from Milwaukee to Madison, and we knew exactly where we were at and how far we had to go. And once we made it into Iowa, we started celebrating, because it's like, okay, now we can, you know, we don't know too much about, you know, the landmarks and the markers and all that kind of stuff. So we felt like that was a huge accomplishment to make it to Iowa.
Now, did you walk around along interstates, or did you choose back roads, or how did you plan out your route?
Yeah, we did mostly county highways and back roads, the best that we could. And there would be times where, you know, we'd be walking down a country road, and we would have paper maps, and we'd have Google Maps as well. And sometimes Google Maps would fail us, and we'd get a little bit lost and have to backtrack for a few hours. So that happened a couple times walking across Iowa, actually.
Oh, man. Well, if you went 2,700 miles and you did it in 5 months, which is 150 days, you didn't miss your 20 yeah. miles a day by too much.
No. We did. We had a couple of really long, grueling days, because we knew we had to make up days that we took rest for. So we really kept track of our timeline and our goal, because both of us, you know, we were taking off work to do this, and Anthony had a young family. His daughter was 2 years old at the time, so we had to do it in, you know, as quickly as possible, as our bodies would allow. So yeah, there are days where, you know, we're pushing 26, 27 miles.
Wow.
And tell our listeners the experience of that when you're on that bridge.
Coming over to Dubuque.
Is
that the one you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
So as I said, like, Wisconsin was really brutal for us. And I think when we got to the Wisconsin-Iowa border, you know, we were pretty broken, I guess you could say. And then one of the experiences, that just to give the listeners an idea of what we looked like, we were sitting in a ditch changing our socks, and the school bus stopped, and the window popped down, and this kid poked his head out, and he's like, "Are you guys hobos?" And we're like, "No, we're not hobos." And so we're pretty beat up and disheveled, and it was hot and humid, and you know how summers go. So we got to the bridge, going over the river, and we had, thankfully we had a police officer who's escorting us in, southeastern Wisconsin, and he's kind of, helping us along the way. And when we got there, the director of the documentary was like, "We really want to get this shot of you guys walking across this bridge." And the police officer was like, "I highly recommend you don't do this," because there's no shoulder to this bridge, I'm sure as people know. So what ended up happening, and the shot made it into the documentary, but we ended up walking. Is one of the most painful moments of the track for both Anthony and I, because you know, our joints were aching and our feet were on fire, and our director's just like, let's get this shot, and we'll get you to the other side of the bridge, and then we'll be done. And then so we did it, and what ended up happening was the director had a minivan, and he had the cameraman in the back of the minivan with the tailgate open. And he was driving on the shoulder, filming Anthony and I in pain walking across the bridge, while we made it about halfway across, we turned around and saw a wide load truck coming that was taking up, it was taking up both lanes of the freeway. So, you know, it was like an Indiana Jones moment for us right there with the boulder rolling down the rolling down the trail behind him. So we had to really move it at the end, and fortunately we made it across right when the truck ended up passing us. So it was an epic scene for sure.
Oh gosh, yes. Well, you know, Monica, you remember when we went across that bridge on the way to Pennsylvania?
I do.
And there was an object, and we couldn't avoid it, and so it happened to put a hole in our gas tank. Remember that?
I do remember that.
Oh wow.
This was in the summer of 1981, and we were heading from Iowa to Pennsylvania. My mom, dad, myself, and my two little kids, one who was like 7 months old and the other was 3 and a half. And so there was something on the bridge. It came up, pierced the gas tank. Someone waves at my dad who's driving to let him know that his gas is leaking, you know, out of his car. He pulls over into a weigh station right on the Illinois side of the bridge. And it was closed. There was nobody there. So this was my dad. Okay. He walked to a nearby farmhouse, called a junkyard that happened to have, this was an older model vehicle that had a mm-hmm. junk vehicle, got a ride there. I think I flagged down a policeman on the road, but anyway, somehow he got to this junkyard, got the gas tank, brought it in. He had a complete set of tools in the trunk along with all of our luggage and baby stuff and so forth, and
right.
He and I climbed under the car and replaced the gas tank, and then we went on our way.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. I think maybe the police officer brought us a thing of gas, you know, like a gallon of gas to put in till we could get to a gas station, and we were
right.
It only delayed our trip by like 6 hours or something like that.
Wow.
The only problem was there was no gas gauge in there.
Yeah, from then on there was no longer a gas gauge, but
no gas.
and my dad died about 3 weeks after that.
Yeah. That was quite an experience.
Yeah. So. So, Tom, do you think that, you know, we read a lot of World War I, World War II novels. We've interviewed a number of authors of those. And there's this concept of mm-hmm. shell shock, particularly
yeah.
from World War I. Do you think that is PTSD and moral injury is what combined to make shell shock?
I think shell shock is another term for post-traumatic stress. I think moral injury is a newer phenomenon that was discovered in the 80s by a VA doctor who was working with Vietnam era veterans. And he understood that there was something else troubling veterans than just post-traumatic stress or shell shock. I think it's in the Civil War, it was called Soldier's Heart. So this has been around for a long time, mm-hmm. as long as battle has been, you know, humans have been fighting each other. So it's unfortunately extremely detrimental to the health of humans and families and communities. And we're seeing that these days with these extended wars. And it's really sad to see.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Tom Voss, author of Where War Ends, A Combat Veteran's 2,700-Mile Journey to Heal. Now, during this trek, you were introduced to meditation, a couple of different ways. Certainly with Father Keating that you talked about, there was a type of meditation. And then was there another meditation teacher that you met along the way?
Yeah, I ended up taking a breath-based meditation workshop that was put on by a nonprofit organization called Project Welcome Home Troops, and they offer free breath-based meditation workshops all over the country for veterans and their families to provide relief from these traumas from war. So I ended up going and taking a workshop in Colorado a few months after I got done with my trek, and that was a transformative experience for me and really helped me bring meditative practice into my life.
And how much of a difference did that make for you?
I think it made a really big difference. And, you know, just going through the workshop, I could tell that there had been a shift or a change, but it also takes discipline and practice, a lot of these meditation practices. So once I knew that this is something that could provide relief from the stresses and traumas that I had experienced, I was all in. And before that, you wouldn't have caught me dead in a yoga or meditation class. But once I knew that it could provide me some sort of relief, that it didn't matter what I looked like or, you know, what I thought other people would think of me by doing it, I knew that it made me feel better. And that was the most important thing, is for any of the veterans that are listening, is finding something that makes you feel better, right? And that's the important thing. The important part at the end of the day, not the optics of what it looks like from other people.
And you had tried a number of other therapies, healing modalities that did not work as well for you, but do for some other people. So do you think it kind of everyone right. has to find their own way to heal?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think I started with VA healthcare, and that's the healthcare that I have today, and that was the groundwork of me finding the help that I needed to feel better. But the challenge is you have to keep showing up. You have to keep trying different things to find out what works best for you. You know, talk therapy, traditional therapies are great because they are a third party that is not involved in the day-to-day, you know, activities as like a loved one or family member. So it's a good way to have a third impartial person in your life to be able to talk about these challenging experiences with. So I was put on medication. I found that medication wasn't the answer for me, and I didn't feel like it was helping me. And in combination, but like I had to go through that first. I had to try it first to figure out that it wasn't working for me. And I think a lot of people get caught in the trap of, you know, finding something and then having it not work and then just being like, well, this is just the way I am. Or, you know, when I first was getting help and put on medication, I was still self-medicating with alcohol. So, you know, I had to recognize that I needed to stop, you know, drinking every night to be able to start processing a lot of these things that I experienced, because before that I was drinking maybe a 12 pack to an 18 pack in the evenings just so I could sleep. Wow. Because my sleep was so disturbed from my time in war, that was what I had found to be able to actually get some sleep, which wasn't really sleep. It was more like passing out. So it's really important to be able to try as many experiences as you can. There's so many different ways to heal nowadays. There's so many different veteran organizations out there that offer many different healing modalities for men and women and families as well.
So there are a lot of possibilities. I think you said that the main thing is to realize that you're not alone.
Yeah,
you know,
yes.
And I imagine you feel like that, though, so a lot of times, don't you?
Yes, it's a very prevalent feeling. I think that when a lot of men and women get out of the military, because I was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, and then I got out and I found myself in Wisconsin, which is not an active duty military state. So there's not a lot of connection to active duty military personnel there. So I felt like I was on an island, and I didn't have anyone else to connect with about these experiences. And that's why peer support, and I found peer support is so important. And that's finding like-minded individuals that have the experiences that you have. Like, that's how Anthony and I connected. Like, Anthony and I didn't deploy to the same place, but we were deployed at the same time frame in the same in Iraq. So he has two deployments, I have one, and we can connect about that because we have similar shared experiences. And even though it's not the same, we can empathize with each other because we understand the challenges that come along with it. And that was a huge support for me when I was walking across the country with Anthony, and being able to talk to him openly and honestly about how these things were challenging me and how they were manifesting in my life. And we were able to share ideas with each other about how we can be better people and how we can move through these challenges together. And then we walk and share and do these experiences that way.
Now, Tom, one of your therapists was a veteran, and that helped you be able to open up to him.
Yeah.
But there was a downside to that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, that was one of the things, the stipulations that I kind of, you know, my sister helped co-author this book, and Rebecca is one of the main reasons why I went to get help in the first place. And we kind of talk about that in the book, where she actually takes me to my first appointment at a vet center. And I put up a lot of hurdles for her to actually go in the first place. And they were that I needed to talk to a veteran, and that veteran had to be an Iraq War veteran. So I wanted it because I wanted to speak with someone that had the similar experiences that I did. So that was my case for her to work on. And she found a clinical social worker who is a veteran at the vet center that I went in and talked to. But at the same time, it was challenging because he was struggling with his own issues as well. And that comes out in the story. So again, we're not alone in this. And there are a lot of men and women who are struggling with this. And the more that we can come together and have conversations and open, honest conversations, more importantly, that's how we're building understanding. And that's why I think authoring this book with my sister, it was so important, is because ultimately she's a family member of a veteran. So for me to be able to open up to her and be able to talk about these experiences was a pretty beautiful thing.
Because there's a big impact on service members, their families, and the whole community that we don't even think about that. That's why I think this book is so important for everybody to read, because we don't, you know, we feel sorry for the guys who've gone through this and everything, and women too from the military now. But we don't understand how it impacts us unless they're family members. But it affects the whole community.
Yeah, and you have to look at it this way, just from like a human resources standpoint. You have men and women who are extremely well trained in leadership and selfless service, and they're not participating in communities. Because they are suffering with these moral injuries of war.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can provide them, you know, with ways to heal, then we're getting these people back online to participate in communities and become active in government and active in the communities where we need leadership, and we need people who are selfless servants and are all about serving their communities.
Tom, I want to talk a little bit more about how the process of writing this book with your sister went. But first, I want to go back to the meditation a little bit. And can you describe,
sure,
or maybe even read from the book where you write about your experience that made you know that this was different, that meditation was different, that it was working for you?
Yeah, So the experience of meditation, or at least what I experienced when I was meditating, was a sensation of relief and peace, and like a restorative rest. So that was something that was really foreign to me, was getting rest. And I think it's really important that we kind of look at things in our lives and, you know, what stresses us out and what brings us rest and peace in our lives. So this was the first time in probably 10 or 12 years at that time that I've ever felt that after being in combat. So I knew that there was something to it, and there was something that I needed to explore deeper. And the only way to do that was to incorporate into my life as a practice and as a discipline. And one thing that I did after I got out of the military was I threw a lot of the things that the military instilled with me out, because I didn't want to associate myself with my military service or with combat or anything like that after my experiences. But unfortunately, what I threw out was my discipline and these other things that are positive traits that the military instills in you. And meditation was a way that I could instill another discipline in my life that was beneficial and that gave me rest and brought peace into my life. And some of the positive aspects of it were I was able to get emotional distance from these traumatic events in my life. So I wasn't getting swept up into a lot of the triggers, I guess you could say, of my experience in war after meditating. I was able to actually look at them from a different perspective of how they were impacting me versus getting swept up in the emotion of the event. So an example I like to talk about is that, you know, if I would smell something that would remind me of Iraq, like sometimes people burn leaves in their yard or burn trash or something like that, that's a very unique smell. And if I would smell it, it would remind me of my time in Iraq. So this is where people end up getting flashbacks and stuff like that when they experience something in their life today that reminds them of an experience that they had during a dangerous time in their life. And that's the link that the brain makes that there might be danger around. So I was able to, through meditation, look at that from a very different perspective and seeing how it impacted me versus getting swept up into the emotions that it churned up in me. And as I started meditating more and finding that bringing back that discipline in my life, I was able to create more space to actually start processing a lot of the experiences that I went through. So that's how meditation has been extremely beneficial in my life.
So Tom, whose idea was it to write this book, yours or Rebecca's?
Well, I think I started writing at about 2010, but it wasn't until I teamed up with my sister that we really started to work on this together. And the way that we really worked on this was I would share my experiences with, I would record them. So we both sat down and came up with a framework of how we wanted to tell the story. And then I filled in the story, and then she would take a pass at writing, either a chapter or a few paragraphs, at a time. And we did this all remotely. So, my sister lives in North Carolina at this time, and I'm in California. So, we would, you know, send through text, or she would ask me questions through text. It was really actually an amazing experience of how we were able to actually accomplish this, because with the technology that we have today, she would ask me a question over text, and I would sit down for a half hour and recount my experiences of these stories, and then she would write them up, and then I would look at them, and then I would go through and edit, and we'd go back and forth like that for about 2 years.
Wow. So did it make you feel a lot closer to your sister?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's important to understand that the only way that we can really have, I think, lasting change or are making an impact in helping veterans is sharing our stories and sharing our experiences of what we went through in combat, but not only just sharing them, but telling people how they impacted us and doing that in the most truthful way possible. And because, you know, as we were talking about before, if veterans aren't sharing our experiences, if we're not doing that, then the rest of the population doesn't know what's going on. So it's our responsibility as veterans to continue our service, to be able to share these experiences with the greater population so we can make better decisions in the future about going to war in the first place.
Now, your publisher is New World Library. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. How did you find them, or how did they find you?
That process, I think we went through maybe 20 or so. We reached out to about 20 or so different publishers and got a bunch of rejections. And that's part of the process is having your story rejected. And we're really fortunate that, down the road, New World Library looked at our proposal and thought it was a great story to share under their under New World Library. So we're really thankful for that.
And were you able to get the publisher with just a proposal before the book was finished?
Yeah, we did a proposal. So that was an interesting process because the process of you can either, do the proposal or you can write the full manuscript. And we did the proposal with all the chapter outlines and how we were going to market it and how we were going to, what our reach was. And we did this big proposal for it. And they thought it was a good idea and a good plan. And for us, that was really, I think if we went the other route of just writing the whole manuscript, we would have still been writing to today. it would have taken us 10 years. But, once you get under contract, you gotta get it done.
So, you have a deadline.
That was really helpful. Exactly. Yeah.
And are both you and Rebecca doing publicity doing interviews and so forth for the book?
Yeah, we're both doing interviews and both talking about our experiences. And she's doing a lot of outreach to family members. So she's talking a lot about how this process worked with, building an understanding of my experiences in the war.
And what's her writing background?
She is a digital content strategist. So she does a lot of digital marketing and strategy for her day job. And she's done some ghostwriting and also travel blog writing as well.
Wow.
So she has a nice background in writing.
Great. Well, Tom, we're out of time, and there's so much to your story. There's so many layers to it, and that's why if you've been listening, go get the book, Where War Ends, by Tom Boss and Rebecca Ann Wynn. And, Mom, do you have some closing words today?
I do. The reality of war is that no country on either side, in case of civil war, wins. Humanity suffers. So seek peace in your life, your family, and your world.
Beautiful.
Tom, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.